You're listening to a 95 BFM podcast.
You're tuned into The Wire. 1 hour of current affairs and analysis starting now.
Tēnā koutou katoa, ko Jessica Toku Ingoa, nō mai haere mai ki te Wire mō tēnei rā. Kia ora and welcome to The Wire for Rapare Thursday. I'm your host, Jessica, and I'll be with you for the next hour. I'm also joined in the studio by producers Beth and Olivia. Whai Akine coming up on the show. I speak to Labour's Andrew Little about creating a single cybersecurity agency, the government's $15 million pledge to restore the St. James Theatre, and a review into our weather forecasting systems. Hannah Thompson speaks to Te Pāti Māori's Takutai Kemp about youth justice. Nicholas Lindstrom speaks to Auckland University Students Association President Alan Shaker about AUSA elections, the upcoming annual general meeting, and calls for a universal study wage. Olivia, what have you got for us today?
I speak to the Green Party's Gulruz Gaharaman about their calls for affordable dental care.
And Beth, what have you got for us today?
I speak to Principal Planner for Rapid Transit Network at Auckland Transport, Luke Elliott.
Hey, aho o whakaaro. I would love to hear your thoughts on any of these pieces today. So get in touch, tuku patuhi mai. Text in on 5395 or wire mai rane. Give us a call in the studio, 309-3879. Ka oe e wari wari e ahe ana koutou te whakarongo ana. Ki ene kōrero, anohi pakiheri roki roki maurunga i te pai tuku tuku o Irirangi Pōho. Me haere ki 95BFM ira kati.com. Catch all these stories and more by podcast on the 95BFM website, 95BFM.com.
Now it's time for our weekly chat with Labour MP Andrew Little.
The government has recently announced that New Zealand's contingency response team will be brought into the National Cybersecurity Centre to create a single agency to respond to cybersecurity threats. I started off our interview asking Andrew Little about why this is necessary. We also discussed the government's planned review of our weather forecasting systems and their $15 million pledge to restore Tāmaki Makaurau's iconic St. James Theatre. Here is that interview.
We had an incident, we have a lot of cybersecurity incidents, but we had one two or three years ago where the New Zealand Stock Exchange was basically the subject of a DDoS attack over 3 days. And it was impeding that business, and obviously Stock Exchange is quite important. What we found was CERT couldn't give any more advice than they used to giving to the Stock Exchange, so they couldn't play a role. The National Cybersecurity Centre thought that this wasn't serious enough for them to get involved because it's just a DDoS attack. They wouldn't ordinarily get involved in that. And the upshot was that here was this major event happening, cyber event happening, and neither of our agencies felt they had the mandate to intervene. We got a bit of feedback, mainly from the business community, saying, look, they need to know that there is help there when they need it for cyber events. We assembled a group to consult and engage not just with business but with government and with NGOs and others about what is good cybersecurity response in terms of the government look like. And the overwhelming feedback they got back was that people want to have ease of access, so they want a single front door, just one place to go, where regardless of how big or small the issue is, they can get the help that they need. And that led us to then take the best of CERT and the best of NCSC and bring it together and have one point of contact that can then kind of triage what the issue is and work out what the help is that is needed that the government can usefully give.
Can you explain what types of cyber security events this body would be responding to?
It would be anything that indicates a compromise of people's either their computer security or their network security. So it could be a DDoS attack, but particularly things like ransomware attacks, things like if people find that their systems are just not working, have them investigated and find that there's malware, that is to say somebody's planted some dodgy software on it that is either slowing things down or taking information and putting it somewhere where it shouldn't be. So those are the sorts of things that that would be covered off. The benefit of CERT going into NCSC is that the National Cyber Security Centre, as part of the GCSB, gets the information that the GCSB gets from their inquiries about cyber attacks from around the world. They will know what the markers are, and then can talk to either individual businesses or, you know, internet service providers or others about what to look out for on their networks that are threats to their networks and to their customers.
And what financial impacts have cybersecurity events had on our economy?
Well, the CERT NZ says that they estimate that the impact of issues they dealt with in the last year was about $5.8 million. And the National Cybersecurity Centre says the impact of the events they dealt with in the last year was about $33 million. So you're looking at, you know, close to $40 million. I think we all suspect that that is hugely underreported. A lot of people deal with issues that they don't bother going to get help with, or they'll go to a private cybersecurity consultant. So we think that even $40 million is understated. But the reality is, too, a lot of these attacks are about taking information, and it's usually people's personal information, and dumping it somewhere. And so the impact of that, you know, is hard to assess in monetary terms. It's a breach of people's privacy, and that's the stuff that we have to protect ourselves against.
Do you think that cybersecurity threats are on the rise in Aotearoa?
Yes, they are, and they are around the world. It's kind of the nature of things now. And there are outfits set up, usually criminal sort of outfits set up in parts of the world where they just make this their business, and they know that with, you know, several billion computers and millions of computer networks, that just by sheer volume of attacks and what have you, eventually they'll get something out of it, and they often do. And that's why, you know, there is a lot of effort goes into making sure that network owners and basic computer owners get the basic protections that they need to prevent this stuff from happening.
And the government is also reviewing our weather forecasting system. Why has the government determined that this is necessary?
So we're looking specifically at NIWA, the big sort of scientific sort of investigative meteorology, and Met Service, which is the kind of the forecaster. They both have critical roles to play, and they both generate different types of information and then provide advice, some of which overlaps with each other. Given the weather events that we're now having and the importance of being able to predict and forecast not only events that are happening but the impact of them, we thought it was time just to review the arrangements that both organisations work under and whether there's anything we need to do to make sure that the services that each offers is coherent and cohesive in terms of what people need, you know, with farmers, transport operators, anybody, you know, given the importance of weather systems.
And is there anything that we've learnt from recent weather events this year that might be considered in this review?
Well, I think it's the fact that we've had the frequency of weather events and the intensity of them that has prompted us to kind of dust off work. Some of this work has been done before to look at whether there's anything more we need to be doing to make sure that everybody gets the information that they need, and you know, can plan with some certainty, even when weather events happen, about what the aftermath might be. So it's just about making sure that the data that it generates is used in the best possible way, and that the configuration we've got for both organisations is the optimal for what we want.
And just lastly, the government has agreed to match the Auckland Council's $15 million pledge to restore the St James Theatre in Auckland. Can you tell me a bit about why the government has decided to do this now?
Yeah, look, we know that this is an issue that's been around a while. There was some money pledged, I think, just before we became government to assist with the restoration of the St James. Council, Auckland Council, has put in their pledge. It's clear that the project is a significant project and needs a lot more support. We think the St James is an important and iconic venue, I remember when I lived in Auckland going to see Stefan Grappelli performing there, so it certainly has meaning to me. But it does for a lot of other people. And a city like Auckland needs a number of entertainment venues. St James is an important one, and so we want to support the restoration and get that really moving. So the $50 million the government pledged is on the basis that York and City follows through with their pledge. So that's $30-odd million, and then there's the $1.5 million pledged in 2017, which is also still on the table. So that gives them $31.5 million to go ahead.
Auckland Mayor Wayne Brown has said that the council would pull their funding and that he would recommend demolishing the St James if construction does not begin by July next year. Would you agree with what Wayne Brown has said here?
No, and in fact, our funding was on the basis that Auckland does follow through with their pledge of $15 million. As I understand it, Wayne Brown has so far said that, yes, they will. I wasn't aware that he had said that he had put a deadline on it. But, no, I think, like, the St James has been an iconic venue. It's an important venue. And, that end of Queen Street is kind of entertainmentsville for Auckland, and, we need it to be thriving.
That was Labour's Andrew Little discussing cybersecurity, weather forecasting and the St James Theatre.
That was Labour MP Andrew Little.
The Wire.
It's time for our weekly chat with Te Pāti Māori's Takutai Kim.
Last week, Labour announced two new policies targeting youth offending, making ram raiding a new criminal offence and a promise to build two more youth justice residencies. The new offence would see offenders younger than 14 being tried and charged in the youth courts, carrying a maximum 10-year penalty. They could be placed in the new youth justice residencies, and while these residencies are designed for 17 and 18-year-old offenders, Calvin Davis could not rule out that 12 or 13-year-olds would be placed in them. These policies see us entering an election season where both major parties are campaigning on tough-on-crime measures. Te Pāti Māori have spoken out against punitive criminal justice policies and against serving those policies on rangatahi. I spoke to Takutai Kemp about using prison-like institutions to address children's behaviour, the drivers behind youth offending, and alternative approaches which centre manaaki and community. I started by asking her where Te Pāti Māori stood on Labour's proposed policies.
Well, amohia ake te oro o te iwi ka puta ki te whaiao. The health and well-being of our people is paramount, and that includes the safety of our tamariki mokopuna rangatahi, whānau hapu iwi. Te Pāti Māori has always been very clear about our stance around tamariki, mokopuna and rangatahi, that their voices must be heard, that their safety is paramount and is a priority for their well-being and a priority for Te Pāti Māori. So the latest, news that we hear of Labour wanting to set up these new units and to set up new policy with Oranga Tamariki and police and how they handle youth offending, we believe is another ploy around we're in election time. It's Labour's response to their tough on crime, kōrero that they have, but is very similar to what is counteracting or the same as National and Act's presence around being tougher on crime. For us at Te Pāti Māori, we always believe actually no one's taking a deeper dive look at what is the root cause to youth offending and youth crime, and there needs to be more work around that. And I remember a couple of weeks ago when we spoke around the Oranga Tamariki, the roof events and how Te Pāti Māori went to Korowai Manaaki, we've always said that we must listen to those voices of whānau, and we've already seen instances where these types of units do not work for our people.
To what extent is a new offence actually needed, considering that burglary is already a crime? So what gap does this fill?
Well, here's the thing, Te Pāti Māori don't even believe that we need to be looking at, setting up these new units. We've been saying for a long, long time that these units do not work for our people. And we've seen this. The system has failed us. And if we look about the treatment of Māori and how our tamariki mokopuna have been looked after in these spaces, we have seen many instances where this hasn't worked for us. And if we go back to the roof incident, before that, there was the sexual violence on Oranga Tamariki staff down in Christchurch with the event of those rangatahi getting on a roof. We then come back up here to Tamaki Makaurau in South Auckland and Wiri with the roof incidents as well, but also with the filming that came out of these of staff members of Oranga Tamariki filming rangatahi fighting inside these units. They're not working for our people. We've always said very clearly that this needs to change and they need to be closed down.
And I guess just considering how rangatahi are treated within these units, one thing that a new law does do that the crime of burglary doesn't is that it will allow offenders younger than 14 to be charged and tried. And similarly, the residencies are designed for 17 and 18-year-olds, but Kelvin Davis did not rule out that 12 or 13-year-olds could be placed in them. So I guess I'm just wondering, like, are punitive measures really the best way to address the behaviour of children?
Well, we've always said that these units, these laws, these policies do not work for our people. They don't support the nature of how we should manaaki, tamariki, mokopuna, rangatahi. There's lots of evidence that show this. And if we go back to the review that was held of Oranga Tamariki, there were whānau voices in there that shared their narrative about being in state care, because essentially the tamariki that are going to come under the care of the state, Oranga Tamariki of police law, being charged in these units. This is not the place to bring up tamariki mokopuna. And we're very clear about that for Te Pāti Māori.
What actually motivates ram raids?
So I've actually had the experience of working with ram raiders, you know, and having them come into our service, especially at Manurewa Wamarai and across, actually, our whānau ora network here in Tamaki Makaurau, across Te Paihiringa or Tamaki. A lot of these rangatahi come into our services and come into our services when they've been introduced into the Oranga Tamariki space. Oranga Tamariki are unable to actually find places, find support networks for these rangatahi. And a lot of these kids actually tell us actually they're bored. Like I said, we've got to get down to what is the root cause of ram raiding, of youth crime. A lot of it, crimes of poverty. We call it pohara. These are crimes of whānau that have been pohara. And a lot of times, instances, these families, it's intergenerational. Mm. And if we think about our tamariki, when they're in whānau that have already been part of the system, whether they've been part of Oranga Tamariki, whether they've been part of the justice systems around and have parents, grandparents that have been incarcerated and in our jails, and a lot of our whānau are those whānau that are represented in those areas. It's our kids that are suffering from this. They're crimes of poverty.
And what's throwing these kids into this quasi-prison going to do for poverty and social alienation?
Well, a lot of times these kids tell us they're bored because the system has failed them. Education system doesn't work for them either. You know, there are other ways that we need to find to engage in finding wellbeing solutions for our rangatahi. You know, there is a network out there, Te Paihiringa o Tamaki, whānau water providers. There are a lot of community networks across Tamaki Makaurau that actually have solutions. And these solutions are actually given and driven by these young people. You know, the thing that we know of years of experience working with rangatahi, they like to make they want to be engaged, but they want to be engaged with people that they trust, people that care for them, and people that will look after them and love them. And those are the types of support networks that our rangatahi are looking for. You know, for us at Te Pāti Māori, you know, we're building a new movement. We're creating and developing He Aotearoa Hau, a new Aotearoa. And we say, what does that look like? What does He Aotearoa look like? You know, for our whānau, for our tamariki mokopuna rangatahi, whānau hapu iwi, it's how we look after you on our marae. We will show you. We will welcome you. We will care for you. We will feed you. We will house you. We will love you. And those are the types of values that manaaki our whānau, that our whānau are looking for. He Aotearoa Hau.
So could values like manaaki and also these more sort of grassroots organisations, these community organisations, could this ground an alternative approach to youth offending?
And definitely, you know, if we take COVID, for example, there was an opportunity there where Māori providers stood up and provided a response. A lot of our Māori partners have solutions, have responses, and that's normal for them to, they know their community. You know, it's local community providing local solutions, and that's what this can do for them. And they have the answers. We just don't look into it enough. But putting another law or another policy on top to locking up our tamariki, our mokopuna, isn't the answer.
Labor have said that these youth justice units will also provide rehabilitative support, seeming to try to differentiate this policy from National's boot camp policy. Is this a meaningful difference?
Well, the current system and the current units are meant to be providing rehabilitation at the present. It's not working. And so why would you put another unit on top of this to say that they're going to provide rehabilitation when it currently doesn't work? We need a new system. We need a new way of working with oranga tamariki. We need to provide another solution for an Aotearoa hou.
And surely rehabilitative support can be provided outside of this carceral context.
Yeah, locking up our tamariki mokopuna isn't the answer.
How would te tiriti fold into an alternative approach to youth offending?
Well, te tiriti is our founding document, our founding building blocks to be able to provide the solutions and, framework for these types of services, programs for our rangatahi. And it's all in the way that we work and we frame these things. We have mātauranga Māori practices that can help. And we've got to be able to find these solutions to be able to work he Aotearoa hou. If we go back to the tiriti and those foundation values that we have as Māori and put them into practice, I think the other thing is too, we don't want to see another mainstream organisation given a Māori name. You know, those sorts of things. You got to have value. You know, believe in us, believe in you, believe in Māori and be proud to be Māori so that we have the answers for these programs and for these responses for our kids. We know how to take care of our tamariki. But again, locking them up, putting them in separate units is not the answer to the manaakitanga and well-being that we want for the future for an Aotearoa hou.
And just thinking about how these alternative policies could be realised in practice, if the two major parties agree on being tough on crime, what space does that leave for more caring policies to operate?
It doesn't. It doesn't. Like I said, you know, locking up our kids, putting them in units isn't the answer for the generation of whānau that we want to grow and build and develop for he Aotearoa hou. That's not showing love, that's not showing careness, it's not showing kindness to our people. Tamariki should not be locked up. And that's just it. They should not be locked up inside these units. These units are exactly like a prison. Yeah, there is no rehabilitation inside a prison network.
That was Te Pāti Māori's Takutai Kemp talking about Labour's youth offending policies and how to address youth offending without using prisons.
That was our weekly chat with Te Pāti Māori's Takutai Kemp.
Classic journal question as well. Can I have a jaw?
The Wire.
Let us know your thoughts on any of our pieces today. Text in on 5395. We'll be back right after this short break. Keep it on the B.
Ever gazed at the seemingly never-ending landscape of the sky, wondering just what might be beyond planet Earth? Uncover its mysteries and magnitude this month with Tūhura Tuarangi, Aotearoa in Space.
Learn and play with out-of-this-world activities that showcase space technology and the world-leading research going on right here in Aotearoa.
Get your hands crafting and mind sharpening with fun and facts for the whole whānau.
Play, build, launch and explore the origins of our night sky this July at MOTAT. Find out more at motat.nz.
Whānau Marama, New Zealand International Film Festival is back for 2023. The world's best filmmakers are bringing their latest creations to Aotearoa. From major award winners and nominees to creations from our very own soil, this is the perfect opportunity to see some truly excellent films. Grab yourself a festival guide from participating venues and create your ultimate NZIFF experience. Whānau Marama, New Zealand International Film Festival. On now till 6th of August. Tickets and info available at nziff.co.nz.
Of course, it is within this.
Hey, do you have a pen?
What?
A pen. I forgot my laptop.
Look, you're going to have to speak up. What was it?
Nothing, don't worry.
Would you be quiet?
What? Honestly, so hard to hear over all this shushing. You people ought to be ashamed. Some of us actually give a hoot about Commerce 335.
Tune in to Ready, Steady, Learn as a motley crew of academics from the University of Auckland take us through a range of thought-provoking topics. Every Tuesday on 95BFM Breakfast, thanks to the University of Auckland.
Why should New Zealanders care so much about this?
Because your children will curse you if you don't.
The Wire.
Welcome back to The Wire. We always appreciate your thoughts on our pieces, and we have a great lineup of political interviews today, accumulated from yesterday and today. So let us know your thoughts. Text in on 5395.
The Wire.
I don't know, and frankly, the whole thing gives me the heebie-jeebies.
The Wire.
The Greens recently announced their 2023 election campaign priorities, which include tackling climate change and poverty and making dental care more accessible. They propose incorporating dental care within our current public healthcare system, reducing its high costs. I spoke to Green MP Gulruz Gadaman about the current state of dental care and the Green Party's plan to tackle these issues. You said your priorities included ending poverty and climate change. What have you done to show that these are a priority for your campaign?
Yeah, so we've had 6 years of, in one term, which is last term, being in a confidence and supply agreement with Labor, and this term having a cooperation agreement. We haven't yet been in a coalition, but given the outside of government role that we've had, we're incredibly proud of what we've achieved over that time. Having an all of government approach to climate action, setting out the infrastructure for even measuring how governments are doing on the zero carbon aim that they've set has been revolutionary. So when James Shaw, our Minister for Climate Change and the first ever Minister for Climate Change, shepherded through the House the Zero Carbon Now Act, he said, you know, this is the infrastructure that will make every single minister in government the climate minister. And that has been true. So now we have ministers across the House, from transport to defence even, having to show that what their area of responsibility is doing to minimise the impacts of climate. And we've already seen that has had an effect. So when it comes to poverty, I mean, you look at the work of Marama Davidson in things like social housing and her role as Minister for Domestic and Sexual Violence, and you see already an approach that's about inequality across the board rather than just to pigeonhole issues that we know are impacted by inequality as being issues of, say, justice, which we can see the big parties doing right now in an election year with no vantage point of, well, actually, what's education, health, the social welfare system doing to contribute to the ways that our society is sort of falling over and marginalised communities are being left behind. But mostly, I think you can see our work reflected in the packages that we've announced now that build on the work that we've done over the last 6 years to say, actually, we can't afford another 3 or 6 or 1 year of tinkering around the edges. We have fully costed policy to end poverty, which says we tax the 0.7% at the top and give everyone in New Zealand a guaranteed minimum income that is livable. So the challenge is to the other parties to provide actually costed transformative policies, not just to reduce a little bit of harm here and there, but to end poverty, to protect nature, and to take real action on climate.
You said in your campaign statement that you're the only party with a plan. How do the Greens plan to achieve these campaign priorities?
Yeah, so we've issued a manifesto, which again, it's funny that we have, you know, the two Chrises running for Prime Minister, and we've got one or the other of them reacting to the news of the day, and then we have the Green Party, who's been the only party to election after election actually release a full dossier of policies. But the most impact, I would say, in terms of the way that we talk about the great problems and the solutions of our times, is to say we will release packages of policies. So our ending poverty package is not only about giving people what they need to not only survive but to thrive, but it's also saying, well, the economy itself needs to be rethought. It's just a tool. People have made decisions that have set these settings where they are. So there's been decisions that mean that capital and wealth is not taxed in our country. That can change. We can say, actually, it's not just about a salaried income, but it's about the accumulated wealth, the generational wealth that so many people don't ever have access to, because we've locked in the system that prioritises the very few. So it's not right to say that 300 people in New Zealand sit on enormous amount of wealth and pay less tax than nurses and teachers. That's not a fair system. So we can fix that, though, because decision makers can do that. And the challenge is to the next government to say, if we can end poverty, which we know we can, we will. We won't just tinker around with a little bit of raising benefits here and there. We will tax the 0.7% of people at the top, as is our ending poverty package. We'll actually give tax cuts to those earning middle to lower income and provide a minimum basic income for everyone. And it's all costed and audited. Same with the dental policy that we released yesterday, where we go, well, actually, who decided that the mouth is excluded from public health? This one area is privatised and extremely expensive. Who said that this isn't healthcare? So the packages fit together, and they are detailed, and I know people always say that you don't want policy detail, but actually I think people do. I think most people are very political. They're just sick of the party politics that kind of doesn't give them the solutions that they're looking for, and so we want to change that. We want to say we are people-powered. We're not a big, rich political party. We run on volunteers and activists. And we are policy focused. We're in it for the actual solution.
What are some of the biggest concerns with the current dentistry system?
Well, again, it's a part of our public health system that is privatised. It's not public access in the way that we have ACC for people who've suffered an accident. We have the general public health system, which isn't perfect by any means, and again, needs a lot more resource. And then we have this one outlier, which is run for profit, because it's run for profit, it's vastly inaccessible to most people. And the impacts that have on broader health is that most people can't afford to have a preventive approach to their dental care. We want all of healthcare to be about preventing the worst of harm. We don't want people to have to wait to do checkups. We don't want people to have to suffer through minor dental issues until they get to be so severe that they absolutely need to go to the dentist and miss out on paying rent that week. That's what is in fact happening. And the other thing that we then see our healthcare system not acknowledging is that dental health can have an impact on all of your broader health. It's something that people are leaving to the very last moment when things are really bad and they may need oral surgery. So it's having an impact on people, and it's an outlier in our public health approach.
You launched the campaign asking people to submit stories of their dental experiences. How do you plan to use this information?
Yeah, so we did this. We've done this in a couple of different ways in the past, and it has had an impact on the way that the broader public and politicians see issues that might have fallen outside of their vantage point. One was with inquiry into student wellbeing and the findings that actually most students in New Zealand are choosing between buying food, paying rent, and things like transport were impacting their wellbeing, that mental health was at a devastating point in terms of young people in tertiary education. So we've presented that to ministers, we've used it to push for change, for support for students. We did the same thing with renters, our renters' right policy, which again is a package where we say housing shouldn't be only for those who can afford to buy, and here are all the ways that renters are suffering, whether it's because they're being pushed to move too many times and it's impacting children and their schooling, whether it's mould affecting people's health, or again, whether it's young people in study having to pay so much in rent that they then can't even focus on their primary aim in life, which is to get that degree and to, you know, contribute in that way without having to work massive hours. So we have taken those personal stories that people have trusted us with and use it to campaign for change. And so people can see the policies that have come out of that, whether it's for student mental health support or renters' rights in our manifesto and that campaign. The same thing will apply to the dental care campaign. We don't think that policymakers are seeing what impact the lack of access to dental care is having on people, whether that's families, whether it's students, whether it's older people. It's just something that has been accepted as a given. Like, oh yeah, it's really expensive and it's outside of the public health system. People shrug and move away, but those devastating personal stories of hardship around dental care, we think will be moving enough to push the campaign to a priority this election.
Do you have any plans at the moment to propose alternative dental policies?
Yeah, so our policy is that dental care should be covered by the public health system. What that will look like for people in different circumstances will be different. So it's kind of, you know, how do we provide that for rural people? How do we include it in terms of, because you see the government constantly saying, oh, well, you know, lower income people will be on the benefit and so they can access the emergency benefits to pay for dental. That's not how preventive care works. So we want to show that and to provide a basis for dental being included in general public health care rather than something that people have to go and get an emergency grant for, because actually going for a checkup isn't going to meet the threshold for an emergency grant. It's only things that are already a problem that will ever kick in for. And yes, that might be slightly more accessible now, but it's still not what we're talking about in terms of preventive care. And so we want to show that actually the public health system itself, just like every other part of the body, is considered to be health, should include that. And I mean, we say this for mental health care as well. It's absolutely the same idea that you shouldn't be in crisis or experiencing hardship with your mental health, same as your dental care, before you can access the public health care system, because we don't say that about any other type of checkup.
That was Green MP Gulruz Gadaman speaking to me about the need for preventive dental care that is accessible for all New Zealanders.
So it's a very odd time to be alive, as they say.
The Wire.
I sat down with AUSA President Alan Shaker here to ask him a couple of questions about the upcoming elections. So, Alan, first up, the AUSA elections are coming up. When are these happening? What are the important dates that students should know?
Well, the first thing is that nominations are currently open. They opened in week one, so 17th of July. They're running through up until this Friday, where nominations will close, and then we'll move into a period of campaigning for a week, and then voting as well. So voting will open on the 14th of August, and voting will close on the 25th of August, and we're hoping to have results announced at the start of September.
And I just wanted to get your opinion on why do you think people should consider running for the AUSA executive position, and what kind of change can come about through running for it?
Oh, I mean, there's so much potential for change. I think, you know, student associations have massive potential to make a huge impact here at the university. If you just look back at the last couple of years as to what AUSA has done in terms of, you know, compulsory lecture recordings for all students and universal grade bump, you know, these things have come from passionate student executive fighting for change. And I think it's a great role because you have so much influence, you have so much potential to make this university better. And I think there's obviously perks to it. It's a paid position. You know, the president's role is a full-time role. The vice president's are 20 hours a week, and the portfolio positions are 10 hours a week. So it's rewarding as well, seeing the change we can make. And it gives you, I would say, over the experience I've had over the last couple of years, it gives you life skills and experience that sets you up for any job, no matter what you go on to after university.
You touched a little bit on it before, but we are students, we've got busy schedules, some of us work alongside of study, so it can be hard to find things like voting in the AUSA elections as a priority. So why do you think it's important that students should vote in these elections?
I think I can't stress how crucial it is. I think, like I said, the student executive have a lot of influence and have a lot of power to make change, and we or they need a strong mandate to be able to do that. You know, the stronger the mandate is, the higher the voter turnout is, you know, the more influence we can make to the university. You know, we can go to the university and say, hey, look, 10,000 students voted us in. Here's what we're fighting for compared to 500 students voted us, and here's what we're fighting for. So I would highly recommend any students out there listening, you know, take the time, take 30 seconds to vote in the elections. All students can vote, so it's not just AUSA members. But, you know, take the time and, you know, have your say in terms of who's going to run the student association.
Yeah, and on that point, I also wanted to ask how voting will actually work for these elections. Like, is there going to be a polling day? Can students do it online? How does the voting work?
So voting is online through the Engage platform. So that's the university's platform. So it'll be distributed, I hope, to all students via an all-student email, across socials. And I believe the AUSA team are looking at doing some pop-up barbecues and stalls and things like that to encourage voting as well. But voting will predominantly be online through Engage.
And I want to switch to a different topic now. Victoria and Otago student associations have just launched a petition calling for a universal student wage. I want to ask you, is this something that AUSA also supports?
Absolutely. You know, it's no secret that students are finding it tough at the moment, probably now more than ever. So yeah, absolutely, we support this, and you know, we're actually part of a general election campaign, you know, and that's with NZUSA, and obviously Vic and Otago are part of that as well. So we are working together with them on issues like this, and in terms of advocating for things that we want to see come out of the general election campaign.
And in your mind, what do you see a universal student wage looking like, and how will that support students to better be able to study?
Well, for me, I think to sum it up, it would be a barrier-free allowance. At the moment, there's many loopholes. The eligibility criteria, you know, if you ask me what they were, I couldn't be able to tell you because they're that confusing. And so for me, a universal student allowance would be something that all students are entitled to, no matter, you know, where you come from, what your background is. And I think the impact it would have on students is immense, because at the moment, students are having to work part-time. I know students that are working full-time to make ends meet, and you know, having this sort of allowance and not having to go through so many loopholes for it eases the burden a little bit, and I think it allows students to ultimately focus on what they're here for, which is at the end of the day the piece of paper you get when you graduate.
The AUSA general meeting is coming up. When will this be happening, and what can students expect from the meeting?
So the annual general meeting is on the 4th of August at 1 p.m. in Shadows. What can students expect from it? So AUSA will be presenting our financial accounts, our annual reports. So, you know, if you're interested in sort of where or how we've spent our money, as well as the things we've done, we'll be presenting both 2021 and 2022 financials and annual report. So we'll be presenting those to our members. In terms of what else is happening, we'll be doing giveaways, so spot prizes, competitions. We've got some awesome prizes lined up from some of our sponsors like JBL. And we'll also have a free lunch. So Shadows will be showcasing their new menu, and the students that come to the AGM will be able to have a free lunch as well.
In the past, student attendance has been low at these things. So you touched on, you know, free lunch, spot prizes. But I wanted to ask about the actual content of the meetings. Why is it important that students turn up and have a say at these meetings?
Yeah, I think you touched on it. The last time we held an AGM, we weren't able to meet quorum. So obviously a priority for us this year is to meet quorum. For me, the biggest thing about these meetings is the transparency. Yes, obviously AUSA, as an executive, we try to be as transparent as possible in terms of what we're doing and how we're doing it. For example, all of our exec meetings are published on our website. But, you know, this is an opportunity for our members and our students to ask us the tough questions if they need to you know, figure out what's happening with AUSA and all that sort of stuff as well.
That was AUSA's current president, Alan Shaker, speaking about the upcoming AGM and why students should look to run for the executive.
Like, naked is the theme. Like, people just love getting naked.
We'll be back after these ads. Keep it on the B.
Hey, what's happening at Ponsonby Social Club this week?
Well, tonight there's
Filthy Junk Traders Live.
And tomorrow,
the Nick Taylor Experience.
Same old Ponsonby Social Club, 152 Ponsonby Road.
The second night of elemental jazz is just around the corner. Friday, August 4 at Neck of the Woods. Featuring Phoebe Rings, the world debut of the Laha, with DJs Carlotta and Mass Appeal's Hudge. And B-card holders, you can win tickets. Just listen to BFM Drive all this week. 95 BFM presents Elemental Jazz, Friday, August 4 at Neck of the Woods. Tickets from ticketfairy.com.
For old time's sake, yes or no, would you like to be leader of the National Party at some point?
No, I'm just focused on what I'm doing. I'm one of those people that do it day by day, job by job.
I'll save this cliff and come back to it in 5 or 10 years. We'll see how it's aged.
The Wire.
Let us know your thoughts on any of our pieces today. Text in on 5395. And next up, we have one more piece for you.
It's fucked.
Yeah, it is.
The Wire.
Auckland Transport has recently announced a draft regional public transport plan, which will take effect over three stages, long, medium, and short term. The proposal outlines AT's priorities for Tamaki Makaurau's public transport system until 2031. Currently, Auckland Transport is in the process of receiving feedback on the plan. Today, I spoke with Luke Elliott, Principal Planner for the Rapid Transit Network at AT, about the plan. Here is that interview. Can you outline for our listeners which public transport issues are AT's priority in this upcoming proposal?
So, obviously, public transport is quite a big area, and so we've split our focus into three timeframes within this plan. So in the short term, which is the next year, our main focus is on fixing the likes of the bus driver shortage and the service reliability issues that have been related to that, while we also continue working on big projects like City Rail Link and Eastern Busway and rolling out the Northwest Bus improvements, which are happening in November this year. And then in the medium term, which is kind of 2025 to 2027, we've got a lot of big new infrastructure coming online, like the City Rail Link, like Eastern Busway, like the new Omahurangi Penlink connection. So there'll be service changes associated with those big pieces of kit. And there'll also be a range of new frequent bus routes introduced, funded by Council's Climate Action Transport Targeted Rate. And those will be introduced across all the different parts of Auckland, so north, south, west and central. And in the longer term, we're working towards getting a lot more people to use public transport, and there are a range of different goal areas within the plan that kind of guide how we're progressing towards that.
What are the steps AT plans to take
in cultivating an improved bus system over this time?
So the first one of those is to address the driver shortage and address the reliability issues related to that.
Mm-hmm.
And thankfully we're on track to do that by the end of this year. We know that that's been really frustrating for customers. You know, I use the bus myself because my local train station is closed at the moment, and so I've felt that. But just at the start of this month, or a few weeks ago actually, we reinstated a lot of the cancelled services, and our cancellations are, you know, a lot better than they were. So that's the kind of key first step. And then if we can get more frequent services up and running, that's one thing that Aucklanders tell us, you know, that really makes a difference to them. They don't want to have to wait a long time for the bus. If one's cancelled, they don't want there to be a big gap before the next one. Because this regional public transport plan, we've talked to a lot of people already to get us to what's in this draft. And that's far and away the thing that people say is most important to them, more frequent services and faster journey times. And so speeding up journey times with new bus lanes, priority at intersections, those sorts of things, that's another way that we're working on that issue.
AT plans to launch the Western Express, a more reliable and direct bus route for West and Northwest Auckland, but has it given any thought to the potential implementation of train services in these areas, especially Northwest Auckland, to accommodate for the immense growth the area continues to experience?
That's a good question. So yeah, you're right, the Western Express is the kind of first step of improvements for the wider Northwest.
Mm-hmm.
And then within this plan, we talk about how over the longer term, we work with the likes of Wangatahi and other agencies in figuring out what's the long-term solution for these areas, not just the Northwest, but for how we improve rapid transit all across Auckland. So some of that's probably beyond the time frame of this RPTP, because we go out to 2031. But those bus changes that are starting in November are the first step.
Do you think that this proposal accommodates for growth in Auckland in general?
That's a good question. So we tried to strike a balance between how we're providing services to new growing areas,
mm-hmm.
and how we also improve services within the existing urban area. So within this plan, over the next kind of 5 years or so, we're planning new services for key growing areas like the Northwest around Whenuapai, Red Hills, Scotts Point and Hobsonville, also out in Kumu and Huapai.
Mm-hmm.
And there's also new frequent services being introduced in the likes of Drury, Oranga, Pairata down south, particularly with the new train stations that are coming online in those areas. Those buses will be able to get people to those train stations so that people don't have to drive.
Mm-hmm. Will those bus systems allow people to commute to train stations from the west, for instance?
Depending on what part of the west, yes. So some of them will be taking people to their local train station, or some of them will be taking them to the new stations that have been set up at Te Aritu, Lincoln Road and Northwest to connect to that Western Express service.
What are AT's plans for a more sustainable public transport system? Will we see more electric buses and trains, for instance? And if so, where in the timeframe can we expect this to take effect?
Yes, there'll be a lot more electric buses coming in. By the end of this plan, which is 2031, around 75% of our bus fleet will be electric. Right now we have around 1,000 or just over 1,000 buses in the fleet, so a big increase from today. Starting next year, we also have two new electric ferries coming in. Those will be higher capacity than our existing ferries, so able to carry more people, but also more bikes and mobility devices. They'll also be a lot more reliable than our current ferry fleet. Those are just the first two starting next year, and then there'll be more coming in over the next few years. And we are also getting more electric trains, so that when the new southern stations and when the City Rail Link opens, we can run more frequent services. So in peak times on the main west, east and southern lines, we'll be running a train roughly every 7.5 minutes at peak times and every 15 minutes throughout the middle of the day, which is an increase from the current 10 minutes at peak times and 20 minutes in the middle of the day.
People are able to submit their feedback to AAT regarding this proposal if they wish. How can they do that?
The easiest way is probably to go to our website. There's a link to the feedback form there, and you can pick which questions in that form you want to answer. So if you want to tell us about safety, for example, but you're not too worried about giving feedback on the environmental side of the plan, that's totally fine. You can select the questions that you want to answer and just tell us about those. There's actually a link in the AT app if that'll take you straight to the RPTP website. But for those that don't use the app, the website is just at.govt.nz/RPTP. If you go to that website, there's also a range of online and in-person drop-in sessions. Those are, you know, at kind of libraries, train stations, bus stations all across Auckland. People can come down and have a chat to us, ask us questions, and they can also give us their feedback there in person. Or if you've got something really that you want to say, you can also email us.
Is there anything else you'd like to add for our listeners before we say goodbye today?
I guess the main thing is, yeah, to have your say. We've heard from a lot of people already, and the plan is our response to what we've heard so far. But the more people that we hear from, the better. So it really is important to have your say, and consultation finishes on the 17th of August.
That was Luke Elliott, Principal Planner for the Rapid Transit Network at Auckland Transport, speaking to me about AT's proposed public transport plan for the next 8 years.
That was The Wire.
Ko ira te hotaka katoa mō tēnei wiki ne te mihi ki a koutou katoa I kōrero me ki o mō tēnei rā. That's a wrap on The Wire for Rāpare Thursday. Thanks to everyone who spoke with us today. Nē rā hoki te mihi ki a koutou I whakarongo ana. Thanks for tuning in. You're listening to 95BFM. Next up is The Wonderful with Eli.
That was a 95BFM podcast. Support 95BFM with a B-card. Go to 95BFM.com/signup.